Hey, welcome back to the next session. This is the session with Brad. We're going to be talking about Windows 10 and how Windows 10 can help you to stay productive. The first thing before we get there is, do you want to just introduce yourself so that folks have already seen you with Rob earlier, but it'd be good if they know who you are.
Sure thing. So I am Brad McCabe. I am product manager inside of our Windows commercial team. So I think about product strategy around enterprise or enterprise users and such.
Cool. So we start off just very briefly there talking about Windows 10 and needing to be productive. What makes Windows 10 as productive as it actually is? I guess everybody's kind of familiar with Windows 10.
Well, I think that's one of the great things about Windows 10. I mean, when you think about productivity, especially from an IT pro point of view, you know, sometimes you're kind of like, well, why do I care about this thing, right? Mm-hmm. And if you think about it as an IT pro, like your main customers and your main clients are the folks in the business and the business itself. You know, so how do we keep them more productive? How do we keep them doing more of what they do, whether it's processing claims or dealing with calls or information workers? And so, you know, that's really what it's about, right? How do we get the business moving? You know, it's not really about, oh, what's the latest thing that we have here, or are we in this version or that version, right? You know, things like Windows are products that enable that productivity. And I think one of the great things about Windows 10 that you hit on is that familiarity, right? That I can sit down at it, I'm familiar with Windows 7, and it's like, hey, there's a start menu here, mm-hmm. and I click and things look really familiar. But oh, what are these little tiles over here? And I can sort of go from what I know and sort of stretch out into these areas as I move along. And then I use it a little bit more. There are things down in the taskbar that I deal with. And then, oh, well, what's this little search box down here? And I sort of find that, and then I grow a little bit in that sense as well.
Yeah, and it's one of those things that I've seen, I think we all have really, we've experienced this for the past few years. There was a ton inside of Windows 8 of really amazingly cool technical features, which IT people really loved. They were really, really helpful. But being able to get people to adopt something which is great from an IT point of view and really has some technically fabulous features in there isn't good unless people can use that product in a way that really does feel familiar. So it kind of can feel that when we're talking about this with the business, they're like, yeah, it's great, but I need this to be something that doesn't have a huge training impact.
Oh yeah, and that's what I love about Windows 10, right? You can take most people who are familiar with 7, you can sit them down. I mean, mm-hmm. there was a lot of good things inside of Windows 10, right? But we had this little, I don't know if you heard, but there's this little start button, start yeah. menu thing.
Yeah, apparently that was a big deal.
It was quiet, it flew under the radar a little bit maybe, but you know, that challenge there hid a lot of this goodness and people didn't experience it. So with 10, you know, there's the start button is back, it's very familiar. And as a user, I can start from that comfortable place and I can grow out from there, right? And we tried to design it in a way that you could grow out from there without picking up the phone and calling the help desk, without having to have IT scheduled training for you, right? That you could just be as productive on day one as you were, you know, on day minus one before you got Windows 10. And then each day after, you would just sort of get this natural progression. I mean, you even see this inside the operating system. I mean, there are some pop-ups and some mm-hmm. dialogues that come out along the way as Windows is like, oh, wow, I notice you haven't done this, or I noticed you do this in this particular way. Hey, could I make a suggestion to help you? And so very much trying to bring those users along mm-hmm. on that journey.
Yeah, and I think there's an interesting thing here. As IT, we can have a tendency to try and overly control that user experience and make it too constrained. So you might, for example, see the Windows 10 start screen and decide that you want all the live tiles to go away so that they don't exist anymore, right? Because then it feels more like Windows 7 maybe to your end users. But that's probably not what your end users actually want. You're probably overly anticipating problems that are probably not going to occur.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I mean, IT is in a tough position right now, I think, right? Because you've got some folks in the organization who are very much, I'll call them old school, if you will, you know, would be very happy with pen and paper if they could, right? And these folks are starting, you know, starting to move through their career journey, and you know, we're starting to see more and more folks coming into the workplace that have grown up with technology. And so, you know, it's not a pure age delineation and line, but you do see these shifts that go on out there. And I think it's really hard for IT because there's this sort of this natural instinct, like you said, of I want to lock it down. I want to control it as much as possible, you know, because anything I do there, I don't get the help desk call that says, where did my widget go today? Yeah. But, you know, as we get more and more people who have grown up and are comfortable with technology, and as we see more BYOD and some more of these pressures of consumerization, there's a huge push from employees to have that freedom, right, that I still want to be able to work, but I want to work my way, and I want to put my start menu my way.
Yeah, and I think one of the things which I always get kind of, I'm amazed every time I see this, but this is a number that I've seen floating around very recently, that by 2025, around about 3/4 of the working population, they're actually going to be under, they are the folks who are currently under 35.
Correct.
They will actually, at that point, account for more than anything else. And they're the people who really have grown up in the place where they're expecting more control over their own work tools than IT has control over those tools.
Right, and with Windows 10, I mean, we tried to design it in such a way, we have very granular control of the user experience. So if you want to put certain tiles certain places or certain icons, you can do some of those things. If you want to lock things to particular things, or you want to lock it to a single instance of an app, all of those things are doable. But I think IT really has to start to get to a point where they're starting to think through some of these things, like, why am I doing this? Is there a direct correlation? Or am I actually just driving up dissatisfaction amongst my customers and my end users? You know, not to say there's not a time and a place to lock things down. There's definitely
kiosk
scenarios.
Style environment. Perfect example of one of the places where Windows is actually very, very well built for the kiosk style environment, and it accounts for actually quite a large amount of the usage.
Exactly.
But it's not necessarily the thing you need to do in every place.
Right. Or maybe if I've got a guy who is out on the lot, he's got a tablet all day, and he's checking in, you know, rental cars, or he's doing inventory around on that tablet. If it's a single purpose device, that might be a great place to lock it down and work with just, you know, very restricted environment. If I'm dealing with an information worker who is dealing with multiple applications and they're using Office and they're going out on the internet to look things up, in that case, you know, especially if that generational change is happening and I'm seeing a lot of tech savviness in that area, maybe I don't want to lock it down. Yeah. Maybe I want to leave it open and see, or maybe I want to try a pilot, gather some data and say, you know, leaving it open really didn't generate any additional help desk calls. And, you know, make your decisions based on data that way.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of places where we need to be a little bit more open with our end users around the way that they're using their devices. Let's switch gears a little tiny bit and think about actually being able to go and deploy Windows 10. And the reality of that is that you need to deploy the operating system onto some kind of piece of hardware. What are your thoughts on the hardware that's required to be able to go and run Windows 10?
Yeah, so I mean, there's a lot of really great things in Windows 10, but if you take a look at the minimum hardware spec, right, if I look at the minimum hardware spec of Windows 10, it's practically the same as the minimum hardware spec of Windows 7, which is practically the same as the minimum hardware spec of Vista. So the minimum bar hasn't moved. I think, you know, we've done a really good job of, as we've taken Windows and we've started to push out over the last couple of years onto phones and the Xbox and the Internet of Things, you know, we've done a lot of work to optimize and focus on those fundamentals. So we can still run on a lot of pieces of older hardware. Now, I mean, obviously, of course, if I've got an older piece of hardware and it doesn't have a touchscreen and I install Windows 10 on it, it doesn't magically get a touchscreen, right? You know, so there are a lot of cool new features that, you know, and if it doesn't have a TPM as another example, right, I'm not going to be able to take advantage of some of the security features that need TPM, but like at a minimum experience, I could run it. So, you know, if I'm thinking about it from an IT pro point of view, I don't have to do a whole PC refresh to bring in Windows 10, right? I can do some PC refreshes where it makes sense or where I was already planning on doing it. And I can do things like in-place upgrades on the existing fleet, and that way I can get to a much more cohesive single operating system in a shorter amount of time.
Yeah, and I think that's one thing that as an industry we've always really focused on has been the standardization across multiple kind of platforms, is to make sure that the standardization is in place so that, yes, the code will run everywhere. We have that in spades inside of Windows 10. We can do that kind of level of standardization. But it's one of those things that people forget is that actually hardware right back to the Windows 7 era is just going to work. That's a kind of a big deal. It's not like there's another operating system on the market where that's the case.
Right. I mean, you know, there are some edge cases here and there. So folks should definitely, you know, especially with some, the older that you get with the hardware, should definitely, you know, take a machine or two in the lab and give it a spin just to make sure that, yeah, you know, something that purchasing bought 4 or 5 years ago didn't have something interesting or weird in it that causes issues. But, you know, generally speaking, it's going to have a good mapping back there, you know. Now, businesses should still think of their natural hardware refresh, right? Mm-hmm. And they shouldn't be like, hey, great, now I don't have to buy hardware for 10 more years type of thing.
Yeah.
Right? There's still a lot of good things, you know. Touch is an interesting one, right? Especially, you know, you put touch in front of people and it's interesting. You know, I've watched this journey with a lot of people, like, I'll never use touch, right? Maybe on a tablet, right? Mm-hmm. Then you give them a touch laptop. I use my wife, right? I know she's not watching, so I'll use her as the example. Right? My wife teaches preschool. She is not a technologist. She swore to me, I don't need touch. She had this old laptop she absolutely loved. It was an old Samsung. And then one day I give her a touch laptop. She's like, oh, this is just stupid. And after a couple of days, you know, she couldn't find the laptop, so she picked up her Samsung. And I saw her doing this on the screen with Internet Explorer, trying to scroll up and down on the web page. And then she started to get mad at me, right? So touch is one of those things. As people go on that journey, they start to find a lot of things, right? I'll find myself typing a lot of times in the day. And for some reason, just my style, I like to reach up and touch, you know, the dialogue boxes. Yeah. So as you think about touch, as you think about two-in-one devices, you know, whether it's a Surface Book, a Surface Pro, you know, any of these great devices from our OEM partners, like, there's great reasons for new devices through your hardware refresh. But with Windows 10, you can also bring those existing devices in the fleet along with you.
Yeah, and one of the things that I think is, you mentioned it early on there, is very important to actually remember is that actually having a TPM inside of the hardware has become really important. Certain things that we've talked about already in the day, device guard, credential guard, being able to use Microsoft Passport for work really effectively, being able to use provable PC health, those things require you to have a TPM to do the hardware attestation that things are correct and are right.
TPM, and then in the case of credential guard and some other things, you know, the virtualization extensions as well, right? Those are some of the things, right? You don't have to have them in that, quote, minimum hardware experience. But, you know, as a lot of people start looking to do things, credential guard, for example, appeals to a lot of our enterprises to stop that pass the hash type of attack. Those older hardware, you know, might lack TPM, they might lack the virtualization extensions as well. I mean, Windows 10 will still run, you just can't run Credential Guard.
Yeah.
You won't be any worse than you are today, but you won't be able to take advantage of those new features.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that folks out there may not have necessarily realized until they've got down the deployment journey with Windows 10 is that if they've bought a device within, say, the past couple of years, that might actually be a device that has things like a UEFI chip instead of a BIOS chip, that actually they may well still be running in a BIOS emulation mode. And if you're doing that, again, you can't take advantage of some of those great functionalities like Credential Guard and Device Guard, because they're going to be using UEFI in order to be able to provide part of the trusted boot capability that's required to really make those technologies secure.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of times, especially as you make some of these OS transitions, you don't like, you know, you hate to bolt a lot of other things on to it, right? You know, but this is a great chance for the IT pros who are watching to sort of step back and just take a look at what type of hardware they have in their inventory. And like you mentioned, you know, the UEFI running in BIOS mode and such. So kind of look around, inventory what you're doing, inventory what's in your environment, and think about, like, okay, these things I've been doing for the last couple of years, should I continue to do them, or is now the time to switch so that we can take advantage of other new features?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. It is time to start kind of reviewing those kind of things. The during the keynote, you actually showed Continuum. Mm-hmm. This is a kind of an interesting area. Continuum allows you to use, essentially, well, what a lot of people think of as Continuum is allowing you to use your phone and connect it up to another monitor. But whereabouts do you see Continuum fitting into the world?
I mean, so Continuum has a broad spectrum. I showed it on the phone because I think that's fun, it's interesting, it's something a lot of people haven't, you know, really got their head around and thought about. But, you know, I use two machines pretty regularly. Not shocking since I work for Microsoft to have both a Surface Pro 4 as well as my Surface Book.
Yeah.
But both of these are great examples because there are a lot of times where, you know, I might be sitting like this with it on my lap working. Mm-hmm. I have a couch in my office. It's actually my favorite place to work. So I admit I'm a little odd in that sense. But, you know, there are times, though, that I'll get up and I'll go to meetings and I just flip it around like this, you know, and I'll grab my pen and I'll start writing in OneNote on the meetings. But I love the fact that things go full screen, the Continuum just makes it work as a tablet for me. Then I get back, whether it's back to my desk or it's back to my couch, and all I do is I just flip it back around here, and now it's working. You know, I don't think about these things, I've actually just told the prompt, just do it. You know, same thing here on my Surface Book. When I'm using this, I love to use it as a laptop a lot, but then I'll also detach the screen a lot of times for meetings. Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is for me with meetings. Like, everyone finds their own killer scenario for pen and such. For me, it's note-taking. Mm-hmm. Like, I can type really fast, but I love to use my pen. And I think part of it is I always feel like when I'm sitting there typing, even if I'm typing notes in the meeting, I always feel like everyone's sitting there going, oh, man, Brad's not paying attention again. He's doing his email.
Yeah.
You know, whereas if I'm sitting there writing with a pen, even though I'm writing a reply to email, hopefully my coworkers aren't watching, with the pen, everyone's like, ooh, he's really attentive, you know, to the meeting. He's taking notes here. But, you know, I love how Continuum just lets me do those things. You know, and then I do also have, you know, I'm the Microsoft gadget guy, I fully admit. I do have a 950, and I have used this multiple times, you know, with Continuum. I mean, just some interesting things, not even work-related, right? My son is a goalkeeper, and so I was recording a bunch of video one day of him on the field to kind of show him things. Then we came home, and I got a 65-inch TV in the family room, right? And I've got the little attachment there, so I could
wide-eye adapter.
The little wide-eye adapter, right? And all I did is I basically connected my phone to the wide-eye. Now I had full screen, my apps went full screen and smart. And while I could drive with my finger, I actually just took my little Bluetooth mouse and I was driving the Bluetooth mouse on the big screen. You know, just kind of showing him things, using the mouse so I could control the slider on the video just to be like, you know, see what you're doing at this frame, and trying to show him some of the things to work on. You know, granted, not in my case a work scenario, but you could start to see how you could do those. You know, last week, for example, I think you were at Mobile World.
And
did you
see
the HP?
I did, actually. I spent the last week down in Barcelona at the Mobile World Congress. And this was a kind of an interesting experience. This is a huge event. I mean, Mobile World Congress is 100,000 people this year. And it's a few pavilions of very, very large stands. It's like a city built temporarily by all of the companies that are involved in any way in mobile. And walking around, I found the HP stand. And there was this huge crowd around one device on the HP stand. And I kind of moved through and got to the front to see what they were looking at. They were actually looking at the HP Elite phone, and it was a Windows phone connected into Continuum, and they were looking at Win32 apps running. And I was kind of thinking, huh, I could Windows Mobile doesn't run Windows 30, Win32 apps. It actually turned out they're actually doing a remote session into HP's own remote app environment that they run for their customers. And they were actually just running Word, Excel, and PowerPoint as full applications. And there was just tons of people looking at these capabilities, thinking, wow, we could actually apply this to what we're doing. But I also saw folks using Continuum in slightly different ways inside of some of their connected solutions there as well. So it was interesting to see that it's now inspiring people to think about how can we use that one form factor in many different ways.
Yeah, I love some of the accessories too that they were showing. You know, my favorite was basically the clamshell that you can put your phone into. Yeah. You know, you have this empty clamshell, you're using your phone. Man, I wish I had my laptops, you know, connect phone. Bam, now I have, quote, my laptop, even though it's all being driven off my phone and the processor in there.
Yeah, and it was another one of the very interesting things was the amount of folks that had a Windows 10 tablet was actually pretty incredible. I don't think there was a single major device manufacturer from ZTE, Samsung, LG. Everybody had a Windows 10 tablet that they were showing, which was kind of cool. It was a nice time to be seeing that. And some really interesting form factors, again, that had just kind of come out of nowhere. And some that were very obviously inspired by Surface as well. But exactly that kind of creativity is being seen across lots of different places. And it's very interesting that they've got all of these different form factors are using all of the different input methods, but in very first-class kind of ways.
Right. And I mean, that's the thing about Windows 10. I mean, it works great with a mouse and a keyboard. Mm-hmm. It works great with touch, works great with pen, and it works great with voice. But they're all first-class citizens, right? So, you know, if I want to be a mouse and keyboard person and I want to live there, you know, 99, 100% of my time, I could choose to do that. If I wanted to live in touch, I could choose to do that. If I want to live somewhere in between, I can do that. And as I change with these two-in-ones and, you know, some of these, you know, I'll invent a new category name and three-in-ones and four-in-ones type of things that you're starting to see come out here, I think they open up a lot of unique possibilities. And I think the way the operating system changes, the apps change, the input mechanisms change, really is going to enable a whole new set of work styles out there. And that, at the end of the day, is really what it's about from an IT point of view, right? You know, kind of a, you know, where we started. We think a lot of times as IT pros about servers and uptime and calls to the help desk, and all those fundamentals are very, very important. But at the end of the day, you know, our job is to move the business forward, keep it up, keep it running, keep it safe, secure, all of those foundational things, but to move it forward in new ways with new technologies and to make it more productive.
Yeah, and I think it's a pretty amazing thing that we can already see that we have over 200 million people using Windows 10 on a daily basis on a variety of different platforms. That adds in a couple of useful kind of data points for IT people. One being, we have a lot of people using this now. Mm-hmm. That's good. But that also means that virtually every combination of hardware that you can throw at this thing is going to work because there are people that are already using it on that hardware platform.
Oh, yeah, I have interesting conversations sometimes with people about the in-place upgrade, and they're thinking about doing in-place upgrades inside of their enterprise, and they're like, hey, you know, I'm not real sure about this, you know, and it's kind of like, well, you know, we've upgraded over 200 million people on the website and in the world, and they're like, but they're consumers. You know, which always kind of makes me smile because if we step back and we think about it, right?
Yeah.
If you got 200 million consumers, if you will, you probably got 199 million different combinations, right? Because there's different hardware, some is old, some is new, different OEMs, and then you start to factor in all the different apps that people can have. And you realize, wow, like doing those as an in-place upgrade where you've got millions and millions of unique configurations that are being upgraded successfully. And then you map that and you say, wow, inside of my enterprise, I've maybe got, you know, 50, 60 different unique configurations between hardware and software, between different departments and such. And so, you know, while it isn't doing it on your enterprise apps, like folks should definitely test those. But, you know, if 100 million, 200 million people and configurations are working, you know, the odds are very good from a starting point that your enterprise upgrade is going to go pretty smooth.
Yeah, and that's, I guess, why 22 million enterprise deployments have already occurred as well, which I think is a pretty incredible number. But a lot of what we've been seeing there as well has been something which I think has been completely unique with Windows 10 and the way that Microsoft has approached it, which is the level of feedback that we've been getting through the Insiders program has been pretty incredible, actually. And that's one of those things that every enterprise is able to take advantage of. The fact that we have such a rich group of, richly diverse group of people giving us feedback means that we have so many different types of testing that we could never have achieved that type of thing just by testing an operating system in a test lab.
Right. I mean, we have, you know, I'm sure you've seen the build labs and such. I doubt many people watching have, but I mean, we have rows and rows and rows of machines after machines stacked floor to ceiling to test different configurations, different software settings, different apps loaded, all these things. But I saw one time a really interesting data point. Someone had done the calculations of the number of different machine configurations times the number of different software configurations and such, and it actually came out to being a number that was greater than the stars in the visible universe, you know, and such. And so when you start to think about that, you know, and you start to think about it on that scale, you know, it's really hard. And the Insiders program gives us a lot of that additional visibility. But it also gives us a lot of additional feedback as well, right? Some of the richest stuff that we get back from the Windows Insiders is suggestions and thoughts and ways to do things differently. And so, you know, I hope everyone that's watching is already signed up for the Insiders program. And if they haven't signed up, I strongly encourage them to go out and sign up, right? Mm-hmm. Even if it's just lab machines inside of their organization, right? These machines should be running the Windows Insider builds, right? It gives you a much earlier look at things. It gives you a chance to provide us feedback. It gives us a chance, you know, to say, hey, I love what you're doing here, but this would just be so much better for me if you just did this, right? Yeah. And the more pieces of feedback that we get, in some ways, feedback is democracy, right? So the more that people say, the more we can hear their voices, the more we can incorporate that in the product. If people aren't giving us their voice and they're not giving us feedback, then we can't hear them to incorporate that as well.
Yeah, and I think that is one of those things which folks are maybe not used to being able to do. Previously, if you were inside of one of our TAP programs, you had a really great opportunity to be able to give us rich feedback that the engineering teams could then take and incorporate in the product. But nobody else really did. We'd have the beta programs that anybody could go and get hold of the beta bits, and we would take that feedback in. But it wasn't they didn't have the kind of rigor around the mechanism that we have today with Windows Insiders. And I think there's a very important piece of the puzzle that maybe we haven't really covered particularly well today is actually around, should you be running certain Windows Insiders inside of your company, and how should you be thinking about managing updates as well? Is there have you got any advice around how we should think about updates and potentially putting in some kind of schema around update levels and update rings?
Yeah, so I think that definitely goes to productivity, right? Mm-hmm. Like we were talking about, there are more and more and more users coming into the enterprise who just want and expect the latest technology, right? You hear it a lot of times from users. There's frustration that they can go to their local store and buy something that can be years ahead of where they are at work, right? Yeah. Now, I get that there are things that come into play. There's management and security and things that the enterprise IT does. So I don't want to, you know, pretend like that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, right, these users really want to stay current, or at least more current than they historically have.
Yeah.
And this is where things like Windows as a Service start to come into play here. But I think you got to think a little bit differently about how you treat your users and how you roll some of these things out. Right. Traditionally, we've kind of come in, you know, with the forklift and we've taken 10,000, 100,000, however big the organization is, and bam, we did this multi-year project, and then we went, whew, done. Yeah. Right. It's kind of like you went out, you ran the marathon, and then you collapsed in your house for a week or so to recover. Mm-hmm. And then you're like, great, got to start training, got to get ready for the next marathon. And you just sort of kept rinse and, you know, rinse and repeat the cycle. Mm-hmm. now with Windows as an update, it's a lot smaller bytes, right? Yep. And so the first thing is, from an IT point of view, I always think about it as chewing, right? Like if I tossed you an apple and said, here, take a bite out of this, mm-hmm. and you tried to take this just massive thing and eat half of the apple, you're gonna have a hard time chewing it. You might, you know, cough a little bit.
Yeah.
And it's because you've bit off so much, it's hard to digest. Well, if you've got 3, 4, 5 years of technology upgrades, mm-hmm. and then you make this jump, you've got a whole lot to kind of consume in that time frame. If you take that same thing, if I throw you a different apple and you take small little bites off of that, right, it's much easier to digest it, it's much easier to chew it, everything about it is easier. Same thing, if I take small bites of technology updates, mm-hmm. then my surface area of change is much smaller, you know, my risk profile is much smaller, everything becomes much easier. I am doing a series of small continuous runs as opposed to marathon crash, do another marathon crash. It's a small series where I'm continuously running. So that's a change. But also how we get out to these employees is a change as well, right? Because if I think about it, you know, it used to be I did all of this work and then I pushed it out to everyone. And I look at how we do things here inside of Microsoft mm-hmm. as an example.
Yeah.
Right? A lot of people think, oh, you're Microsoft. You know, you're a technology company. Everyone there is like a super geek. We have HR departments. We have finance departments. We have marketing departments. You know, mm-hmm. we have lots of departments that have what I will call mere mortals, yeah. right? Normal users
regular
that you'd
people.
See anywhere, regular people. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we've got coders and developers, but let's kind of sit them aside because, you know, they're a bit of an anomaly. But what we have inside of Microsoft is a program called Microsoft Elite. Mm-hmm. And people can sign up for that, and that's the early adopter program. And so MSIT is able to push out early builds of the operating system to them and get some real-world feedback, right? And this changes a whole lot of things. As someone signing up for that, you're making a trade-off here. You're saying, yep, I'm going to raise my hand. I want early access to this stuff. I want to be bleeding edge. But I also understand, hey, I am bleeding edge. You know, some days might have a rough edge,
yeah.
right? And some days IT might have to roll me back, but that's the trade-off I opted into. And you look at Microsoft, and we have thousands of people in this around the company and a lot of these places that you would not expect as being, you know, technology-centric, mm-hmm. right? So then you get to push it out to them. Now, the thing you also get there is real-world app compat testing. Think about how a lot of people test apps, right? Mm-hmm. They put it in a lab. Some guy who has a script and has no clue what the app does just kind of follows the scripts yeah. and writes it down. It's incredibly expensive, and I don't understand, is this error and this error the same? What's the prevalency of these, right? So you can do some basic app compat testing, some smoke testing and such. Then you can push it out to that first ring of insiders in your corporation. Now you get some real-world testing. If there's a problem and it's major, you roll it back, and if not, you start to understand, hey, this function has a problem, but it only gets run about once every 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should keep going.
Yeah.
And then you can define other rings inside your organization of these users. And you can start to move from one ring to another, right? Quality looks good in here. Bam, let's go out to another, you know, 10% of the company, mm-hmm. right? Quality's looking good. We've gotten more coverage, deeper testing, more apps. Things are great. Push the button. Bam, now we've added 25%. Additional to what we were. And you could do that out, right, to 100%.
Yeah.
And then you could still have, you know, outside those rings, your really mission critical things in a little bit different state so that they're not seeing those types of updates.
Yeah, so it's a case of having those, kind of deciding upfront, what are going to be your rings and where are they going to be and what are the kind of applications that really matter so much so that your business can't work without them. You make sure that those are tested and fully working. And then you think, what about the stuff that, okay, maybe we can survive for a few days if people have to apply some kind of workaround to get their daily job done.
Exactly. I mean, it's a different method, right? You've got to kind of step back as an IT pro and think about things differently. And it's, you know, it's outside the comfort zone, but, you know, it is one of those things that you can walk down more.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the I think one of those kind of things, as we start to see things that are slightly outside of the comfort zone, we've actually had a question come in here around from Ken Weston around what's the business case for using Cortana inside of an enterprise setting. And it's one of those kind of funny areas. I've actually, you and I, have been mm-hmm. using Cortana on our machines for quite some time. And there are certain things that I now personally just do as a Cortana task. So things like opening up Excel, for example. I very, very, very rarely hunt around for the Excel icon right. to launch it. I actually just tend to say, hello, Cortana, start Excel. And then Cortana will actually start up on my machine to make sure that I have access to it. But are there some other kind of places where Cortana is being used inside the business?
Yeah, so I mean, you know, there's the basic intelligent assistant or personal assistant scenarios here, mm-hmm. you know, starting things. I use Cortana a lot when I travel. You know, I just ask Cortana rather than going out. I'll ask her what the dollar is to the euro, for example, mm-hmm. so that I get that information as I move around. You know, my favorite little thing, it's trivial, but I find I do it a lot, is I just use Cortana to do basic math functions for mm-hmm. me rather than firing up calculator.
Yeah.
Just one of those little time savers of, you know, start, find calculator, do my little math. I just ask Cortana, she does it, gives me an answer.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't have to think about, okay, what is this times this percentage divided by this number sort of thing. But then also there are other places you can extend Cortana out. So there are hooks and APIs that you could extend Cortana into line of business applications. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you could go deeper than saying, hey, Cortana, you know, start Excel. You could have her do a very particular task specific to the company, you know, in that line of business app. Also, some of the things that we've shown that we're working on, we're integrating Cortana with Power BI. Mm-hmm. This is one of those challenges I always seem to have. You know, you go into a meeting with a bunch of executives and I've got every, you know, possible set of metrics and numbers that I think. And then I have an appendix with everything I can possibly think of, you know, like they might go here, they might go here. Yeah, I should put this. And it always seems like inevitably I'm in the meeting and someone goes, you know, How many, you know, people wearing red shirts standing on one foot like popsicles in Fargo? And I'm like, man, that's the one stat I did not put in here, right? Well, you know, now with Cortana, when she ties to Power BI, you know, you can talk to her, like, you know, everyone gets that. But with Cortana, you can also just type.
Yeah.
So, you know, I can just type in, hey, you know, I can type into Cortana and say, how many people with red shirts standing on one leg like to eat popsicles in Fargo? Mm-hmm. And she'll go out, she'll query the data in Power BI, right? She'll understand that, and she can come back and tell me it's 42 people. And so, you know, I'm very quickly and easily able to go, oh, it's 42. You know, so just doing these little things to make you more productive.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you'll continue to see her push out and such more and more into those types of scenarios.
Yeah, and it's very interesting when you look at the places where Cortana starts showing up and the kind of things that she's doing for you. So you can type your information in there, but also it's remembering what's actually happening across all of the different devices that you use. I think that's that's one of those places where we're starting to see enterprise state roam, but I think there's another place as well, which is being able to roam those bits of information that really matter to you.
Right.
And one of the things that I love is the ability for Cortana to actually keep you honest on certain things and actually remind you that you said this inside of an email, something that you potentially wouldn't have thought that would be a capability actually surfaces very quickly.
Well, I use Cortana a lot for scheduling, especially when I'm on the fly and I want to remember something or I want to add something. Mm-hmm. And this is where I love the fact that Cortana is everywhere for me, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, I have my band on, as do you.
Yeah.
I am really this much of a gadget geek. I don't get paid like a dollar for every product placement here.
Not quite.
But no, I do love it. I love Cortana on my band because there'll be a lot of times where I'll be doing something. I'll just be in a place where my phone's not convenient, my laptop's not handy, mm-hmm. you know, and I'll just use Cortana on my phone and I'll say, you know, remind me when I get to work to do X, and then she takes that and geofences it, so she pops up and reminds me, or I'll say, hey, you know, add to my schedule, you know, a meeting tomorrow at 9 to call Simon to talk about our next project, right? Mm-hmm. And she'll just do those things for me. You know, and I might be at the gym working out when it crosses my mind, and I'm able to just say it, you know, to her and have it done. And then when I get to work the next day, there it is in my Outlook waiting for me.
Yeah, and I think one of the questions that we've had come in is what are the future benefits of things like Katana Analytics to teams like IT? And I think that's a very kind of interesting question, because if Katana is your virtual assistant, mm-hmm. and you need some assistance from IT, well, maybe potentially in the future we'll see some integrations through those APIs that might just immediately notify IT that there is something that you need help with as an individual. So there's a lot of places where the technology could actually to go into leveraging those things. But I think it's important that IT actually also realize that Cortana can help with a productivity flow. That's the most kind of critical thing, is it's helping your end users.
Yeah, I mean, and it's things like this start to get into a very gray area, right? It used to be very black and white, right? Technology, IT does it. Mm-hmm. Now business groups are getting more and more capable of doing some of these things on their own, right? They spin up some of these shadow IT. So, you know, is it the business group's responsibility to implement something like this, or is it IT's responsibility? I mean, your mileage may vary because every organization is different, but I mean, for me, if I was in IT, these are some of the really cool, fun projects. And like, I think that it is best for IT to get out and in front of these. Mm-hmm. You know, IT has always got this tension and struggle of, you know, how much work we have to do just to keep the lights on? Like, how the heck are we gonna do this? But, you know, as I think about my career when I was an IT professional, like these were the types of projects I really wanted to do. It, you know, the setting five group policy settings that I needed to keep things up and running were important, and I did that. But you know, these are the things as we kind of go through this shift in the industry that we have to work through.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. We've had a question come in which we always get every time we start to mention anything about Cortana. And I just want to make sure that I just want to answer this question very, very quickly, which is, what are the future plans for Cortana for non-English speaking regions? That's actually a question we get a lot, and it basically comes down to prioritizing the most popular languages first, because actually understanding dialects is a really, really tough job. And you would think that in certain circumstances, it'd be easy. There are many different folks inside of Redmond who could potentially go along and lend their voice and their dialogue. But one of the things that happens is, as soon as you're taken out of your native culture, you start to absorb the other language aspects. So it actually makes for a very difficult test pool. We really have to do that kind of work directly inside of those areas. Right.
So, I mean, Cortana has been learning more and more languages. She's been broadening out, you know, she continues to hit the books and study hard, you know, and such. But exactly, like there's a lot of dialect, there's a lot of training that goes into these different languages. But it's also beyond the language, right? Cortana, when she goes into an area, has to learn a lot about that area, mm-hmm. right? If you want to, you know, just beyond dialects, there are particular phrases to that area. There's also restaurants, there's things to do in those areas. All these things you expect an assistant to know beyond just, hey, can we talk to each other? Mm-hmm. That, you know, she has to learn, she has to absorb, right? So that if you say, hey Cortana, you know, what's a good Chinese restaurant for dinner? And she's now going to answer you.
She is actually going to answer that
on your screen. Device. Yeah. But yeah, if I say something like that, you know, she needs to know, as she does right there, a good list of places we should head out to for lunch or dinner. So, you know, there's a lot that goes into these things. We continue to keep working through them, and we'll have, you know, more announcements as they become practical.
So, let's move away from talking about Cortana for a moment and start thinking about some of the other kind of pieces of hardware, some of which I've already mentioned that appeared at Mobile World Congress, but more specifically around some of the other places that we're going to start seeing Windows 10 as well, around Surface Hub, those mm-hmm. kind of areas. folks, if you've got questions, then please feel free to send them through to us using the using the hashtag TechNetVC and also on the chat inside of Channel 9. I am seeing those questions as they come up at the moment, so we're going to answer a bunch of those in a couple of seconds. But Surface Hub, what's the place with that? Where's that going to be used?
Yeah, so I mean, Surface Hub is great. I say that as a guy who has spent time in buildings equipped with Surface Hub and buildings without Surface Hub, mm-hmm. right? It's really painful in some sense now when I go into conference rooms that we haven't upgraded at Microsoft because it's, you know, I know, it's a first world problem, but, you know, I have to go in, I have to plug in the video, and I futz around trying to get the screen to come up, and then, you know, now I'm really going to sound like I'm whining here. I got to dial the phone and log into mm-hmm. the conference, and, you know, it's just nice when I go in with a Surface Hub because it understands mm-hmm. who's the next meeting, and I walk in, and it's like, hey, it's Brad's meeting, click here to start. And I click it, and, you know, hey, it fires up Skype because I have mm-hmm. Skype set to the meeting, and the cameras come on, and the screen is just there, and the whiteboard is set up and ready, and, you know, all this is just taken care of. Like, I spend so much less of my time at the start of a meeting mm-hmm. in these places than I do. And, you know, it's changed meetings as well because, you know, outside of whining about plugging in monitors and dialing phones, you know, there are other things, which is I love to write on the whiteboard in meetings. Mm-hmm. And that's really hard in a traditional conference room. You know, sometimes we try these funky things where it's like, oh, wait, let me get the webcam on and I'll hold mm-hmm. my laptop. Yep. So hopefully I can
so
show it to you.
On the phone can actually experience what you're doing on the whiteboard. Yeah,
exactly. And you know, with the Surface Hub, I just grab the pen and I start whiteboarding away on it, and I don't have to think about sharing that. No one has to do funny gymnastics with their
with their laptop in order to be able to capture the screen.
It's
funny because we started this session talking about productivity, and it is one of those strange kind of things. If you're used to doing any kind of meeting where you're connecting into some kind of voice conference and etc., you probably lose about 20 minutes up front of the entire meeting. Yeah. Everybody gets connected. And the difference between that and walking into a room which is connected with Surface Hub is a really huge thing. And under the covers, it's just a Windows 10 device
right.
that's making all this stuff happen. There's a Windows 10 device that knows that there's other Windows devices in the room and can bring them into the environment.
Right. But the fact that it is a Windows 10 device, I don't think is lost on people on campus like Microsoft IT. I don't mm-hmm. think it would be lost on a lot of the folks watching, just because it is a Windows 10 device, right? So I know how to manage them, I know how to secure them, I know how to think about mm-hmm. them. It's not like, oh my gosh, here someone ran off and brought in some weird foreign technology into my conference rooms, and now, is that opening security holes? How do I keep those things running? Mm-hmm. Right, this is all skills that I know and I'm familiar with, and it just transfers over. And if I wanna do things like run particular apps or do other things on it, it is just a Windows 10 device. So those things just work, I can log in, all of that is just seamless for me.
Yeah, it is an amazing kind of thing to have that capability. There's a question that I've just seen that's come in that I really wanna ask actually. I think it's interesting the way that this question has been phrased. So the question that has been asked is, how do the different versions of Windows compare with LTSB? Mm-hmm. And that's an interesting thing. When we were talking about updates, we didn't really mention LTSB, long-term servicing branch, if you're unfamiliar with it, in any great depth at all. But then it's interesting that people see them as different versions rather than just different editions or not even different editions, different update cadences.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, at Microsoft we like to name everything mm-hmm. and then we like to make acronyms for every name. And so,
yes.
you know, we've talked about this current branch and, you know, we call it the CB and this current branch for business that we call the CBB and then the long-term servicing branch that we like to call the LTSB. Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes talking about all these different terms has confused folks, right? So first off, if I think about the current branch, which I'll call the CB just to keep things easy. Yeah. And the current branch for business, which I'll call the CBP, just to see who's paying attention to catch the extra B. Like, if I think about those two, let's just put the names aside for a second, right? Because what the current branch for business is about 4 months after when we've applied various cumulative updates and such, then we call that the CBP. And a lot of times people ask me, well, you know, what's different from the current branch, you know, at that point and the current branch for business, and how do I get from one to the other? Actually the same thing.
Yeah.
Right? It's just this kind of moment in time. And if you've had a machine on this current branch and you've been getting those cumulative updates along the way, you're there. Right? And so sometimes people get wrapped up around the names as opposed to the concept. So, I mean, think of the first 4 months after the release as the chance to pilot and test it inside of the organization. And after 4 months, think about that as the time to think about doing the broad deployment of that. And that, to me, is a much easier way to think about it than trying to think about names and such. Now, there is this separate thing, the long-term servicing branch, or the LTSB. This is for those special systems, right? Mm-hmm. The machine that's running the 911 call center, the machine running
a heart monitor.
A heart monitor, yes. Yeah. Air traffic control, right? Mm-hmm. The nuclear power plant down the street, right? These are things that very specialized systems that you want to put in a state. In most cases, they don't have a user, or they have a user who does very, very defined task-specific things on them. Mm-hmm. And you want that machine locked down, not changing. There's no reason, you know, to see these new features or functionality on that machine. And you might want it that way for 3, 4, 5, 6 years, right? And this is where you use the LTSB. The LTSB is not going to see new features like the current branch or current branch for business, if we use those terms, right? Like the main line. It will see hot fixes and security updates, those types of things, but that's it, right? And so this is what you put on those very specialized systems. And it's not seeing those new features. So for those users and productivity, like we were talking about, you know, this is probably not the right answer. But it is the good answer for those specific systems that are very specialized.
Yeah, and there's certain things as well that aren't available to you into LTSB. So you can't use things like apps that come from the Windows Store inside of LTSB, because the Windows Store isn't there.
Well, also because if you think about it, you know, apps that come from the store get updated on their own cadence, the cadence of the developer. That tends to be much, much quicker than many, many years. You know, so you think about some of these scenarios, and these are scenarios that introduce a lot of change in a platform or, you know, or a branch, if you will, that is designed for specialized places that don't want to change. Mm-hmm. And so this is why it's probably not the right solution to roll out to all of the users across the organization. There are a lot of things that users do want to do that change and update on a much faster cadence, and those are going to be limited.
Yeah. We also had a question from R. Ken Watson around the types of data that Windows is actually collecting. And this is kind of an interesting place, because just in the November update, and Jason mentioned it a little bit earlier, we've actually enabled some more controls to be able to say yes and no to sending some of that data. And there's a pretty huge, I think it's about a 30-page document on TechNet that you can follow in order to actually put that in place to be able to turn off some of that data sharing. But I want to just point something out about turning off data sharing. If you turn off that information that's giving, that's providing some of the telemetry back around how you're using Windows, it kind of defeats some of the object of being that close to the development cycle.
Yeah, I would definitely encourage folks to go out and read the white paper, right? Mm-hmm. It's not 30 pages or however long it is, I don't know the exact length, because that's all the steps you need to do it, right? It's actually quite easy to adjust the level. And you see this when you look at the document. But there's a lot of detail in there about, you know, what's going, how it's going, you know. But, like, our goal is not to collect personal information. Our goal is not to collect business-sensitive information, right? We spend a lot of effort making sure You know, that's not happening, right? Our goal when it comes to things like telemetry is to understand, you know, heartbeat information, if you will, usage information, right? So a good example is not too long after we launched, we saw a scenario, and it was a very specific scenario with a particular third-party video driver that caused things to crash. We were able to see that very early from telemetry, right? We were able to gather that information. We were able to go to that third party and we were able to say, under these scenarios, here's a problem. We worked with that third party, we got a fix, and we put it up on Windows Update very, very rapidly, right? You know, and so with that type of information, we can turn around those types of things before people actually have to start calling, right? So those things, you know, in most cases, we can turn those types of things before we start hearing calls and before, you know, internal help desks start hearing calls and resolve those types of things. Another good example is around just basic usability and functions on the machine. I suspect if I could see out to the audience and I ask this audience how many people use Alt-Tab, I would see almost everyone's hands up here, right? Yeah. If you go out and you ask that to the general population, like we could see this from data from Windows 7, it is less than 5% of people that use Alt-Tab. I always joke that anyone that uses Alt-Tab can also tell you what Windows for Workgroups is. Yeah. But, you know, the people that use Alt-Tab, if I asked the audience again, if the, you know, if they were here in the room, of those with their hands up, how many love Alt-Tab? Probably almost all of them would keep their hands up. You know, so we looked at this, we said, well, people that know Alt-Tab love it, but most of the world doesn't know Alt-Tab exists, right? So you look at Windows 10 and there's the little icon right down next to the search bar for the task view, right? You click that and it gives you the same functionality. You know, we can see all that functionality usage being used close to 50% of the time now. So by understanding how many people were using something or were not discovering something in this case can lead us then to find other ways, right? And same thing tying back to the Insiders program. We can do various A/B testing in the Insiders program. So we can say we think we've got design one to solve the problem. We think we've got design two to solve the problem. Push that to the insiders, to two different groups, see how the responses happen, right? Like here it gets found in under 10 seconds and two clicks. Here people find it in 20 minutes and 37 clicks. Obviously this design is the answer and the way we should go forward. So there are controls. I encourage people to check out the white paper out there. But there is, like you said, there are good values and reasons to keep going with it.
Yeah, for being able to use that technology. So hopefully that's given you a view into the minds of what we're actually thinking about with Windows and the way that it can help you to be more productive. We cover quite a lot of ground there around productivity, around the types of devices that we're seeing, around Cortana, and also quite a lot of information around updates and around telemetry as well. So hopefully incredibly useful to you. Keep the questions coming in on the hashtag, hashtag TechNetVC. Also, you can tweet any questions directly to @SciMonster, which is my own handle, and you can ask any questions inside of the chat on Channel 9. We're going to hand back to the broom code for a couple of seconds to Jerry Snow, who's going to take you through something else.